5:55 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. North Korea launched at least 4 missiles, 3 of which are believed to have fallen within Japan's exclusive economic zone. South Korea's Prime Minister and Acting President Hwang Kyo-an condemned what he called North Korea's disregard of the international community's consistent warnings and called the latest launches a serious provocation. Japan's Prime Minister said his government is collecting and analyzing data from the launches. Earlier last month, the North Koreans launched what they call the Pukguksong 2, calling it a new kind of strategic weapon. RAND Corporation analyst Bruce Bennett doesn't believe the North was reacting just to new South Korean U.S. military exercises, but rather sending a message to China.
You don't need a missile that can fly as long as these missiles flew to hit anywhere in South Korea. And North Korea has been very upset about the Chinese attitude on its coal import cutoff from North Korean coal. So, yeah, this was a launch that was intended to defy the United States and South Korea for doing the ongoing exercises, but it was also clearly pointed at China.
Bruce Bennett said he sees the apparent assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's half-brother in Malaysia as another act of defiance against Beijing. A Briton was shot to death, apparently by pastoral herders in the Lakapia area of central Kenya. His body discovered Sunday after South African-born rancher Tristan Verspoy, a father of two, went to inspect his property after some lodges were burned. Some officials blame the land evasions on the region's current drought that forced many herders onto private land in search of grazing areas. Others link it to a stoking of ethnic tensions ahead of Kenya's election. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump is demanding the intelligence oversight panels investigate whether former President Barack Obama's administration abused its investigative powers ahead of last year's presidential election as part of a probe into Russian meddling in the vote. Mr. Trump alleges his phones were tapped at his Trump Tower headquarters in New York ahead of the election. Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, who served in the Obama administration, said there was no such wiretap activity mounted against the president-elect as a candidate or against his campaign.
I can't speak officially anymore, but I will say that for the part of the national security apparatus that I oversaw as DNI, there was no such wiretap activity mounted against the president-elect at the time, or as a candidate, or against his campaign.
Clapper said, to his knowledge, there were no court orders allowing any such wiretapping as current law requires. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Sunday accused Germany of employing fascist actions after canceling rallies by Turkish Germans in support of next month's referendum granting him sweeping presidential powers.
Arkadaşlarım bazıları faşizmden bahsetmişler.
The Turkish leader said he thought Nazism had ended in Germany, but he says it turns out it's still going on, plain and visible. Germany called off the rallies over security concerns. The UN Sunday said months of fighting in northern Syria displaced 66,000 people. Meanwhile, 2 suicide blasts hit near the IS-held town of Deir Hafer, another striking the rebel-held town of Azaz, both in Aleppo province. The Islamic State is suspected of carrying out both blasts that reportedly killed several people. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will travel to Moscow Thursday for talks with Russia's President Vladimir Putin about Iran's growing military presence in Syria. Sunday, Mr. Netanyahu said Tehran is trying to base itself permanently in Syria. Joseph Olmert is a political science professor at the University of South Carolina.
It's about time that people outside of the Middle East, whether in Washington or elsewhere, will pay attention to this concern in Israel, because the Israelis mean business when they say that they would not like to see Iranian military presence in Syria. They mean business.
Last November, the chief of staff of Iran's military said he hopes to establish naval bases on or near Yemen or Syrian territory. French conservative presidential candidate François Fillon has vowed to supporters in Paris to remain in the race despite a scandal involving the payment of public funds to his wife for little or no work as his parliamentary assistant. He denies wrongdoing, but official investigation is possible amid mounting pressure on him to stand aside. A major earthquake measuring 6.5 magnitude struck Monday off the southern coast of Papua New Guinea, the tremor hitting at a depth of about 30 kilometers near the sparsely populated island of New Britain. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatie in Washington. Today is Monday, March 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Sudanese lawyer is vowing to appeal the sentences of three human rights activists.
I think, well, number one, they were convicted without enough evidence. And number two, the sentence was too harsh.
Nabil Adib is the lawyer for two of the three human rights activists sentenced yesterday in Sudan. In neighboring South Sudan, there's been a call for the release of political prisoners to advance national dialogue. There's a new candidate for Sierra Leone's 2018 presidential election, and a Supreme Court ruling in neighboring Liberia has thrown a murky wrench in the country's 2017 presidential election.
The constitution of the Republic of Liberia gives everyone the right to exercise their political rights. The law is coming into play that will stop other people from exercising their political rights. It just disappoints me.
Selina Paulson Mappe is the superintendent of Liberia's Bong County. Facebook's head of product wraps up a tour of West Africa in Dakar and the latest mobile innovation as the technology is transforming economies in many African countries. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Sudan, the lawyer for two of the three human rights activists sentenced yesterday said their conviction lacked enough evidence and that their sentences did not fit the alleged crime. A Sudanese court sentenced human rights activist Khalifala Al-Afif, Mahat Hamdan, and Mustafa Adam to a year each in jail after they were convicted for publishing fake reports or spying. The three men worked for the Center for Training and Human Development, known as TRACS, a group of providing training in human rights issues. Nabil Adib, the lawyer for two of the three, says the harsh sentences amount to illegal imprisonment.
I was representing two of them, and the two I was representing, I think, were, number one, they were convicted without enough evidence. And number two, the sentence was too harsh. And for one of them, it actually exceeded what the section he was charged with prescribed as punishment. Because the section prescribed punishment of imprisonment for 6 months, and the judge sentenced him to 1 year in prison, which amounts clearly to illegal imprisonment.
Which of the two did you represent?
I represent those of TRACS, Khalifala Al-Afif and Mithat Hafifuddin.
Well, you said you don't agree with the evidence, but the judge said that, for example, one of your clients, Khalifala, was arrested for publishing false reports or fake reports.
That was not true, because the evidence adduced in court does not show publishing any report of whatever. What they have presented as evidence was material of training, people who are human rights defenders, how to detect human rights abuses and things like that. Another document presented and the judge seems to rely on is a motion picture. It is a film that is a work of fiction. It is not a news report, and it was in his laptop. He downloaded from the network, and it's a motion picture. So you can't be convicted for watching a film.
What do you intend to do now? Do you intend to appeal, and what are your chances if you do appeal?
I am intending to appeal. And I think they stand a very good chance of having this conviction passed. It won't stand.
What do you think about human rights in Sudan? When we talk to government people, they say that freedom of press, freedom of everything is good in Sudan.
Well, you know, there are human rights abuses, and that's why Sudan is under agenda item 10 of the Human Rights Council. We have an independent expert assigned for Sudan, and he presents reports about what is going on in Sudan. And there are abuses here and there, and the government should accept this in order to improve the situation. It's a matter of internationally recognized situation where Sudan is regarded as a country that needs help in that respect.
When do you hope to file your appeal?
Well, it will take some time. We have a chance of 2 weeks, so it might be in a week's time.
Nabil Adib is the lawyer for two of the three human rights activists sentenced yesterday in Sudan. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. The Voluntary Civil Society Task Force on Implementing South Sudan's Peace Agreement is calling on the government to release all political prisoners, allow media freedoms and freedom of expression across the country, as well as guarantee the safety of all participants in the national dialogue. As Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba, the task force is also recommending that President Salva Kiir relinquish his position as patron of the dialogue.
The coalition of more than 20 civil society organizations held three consultative meetings over the past 2 weeks. 260 participants from civil society, youth and women groups, persons with disabilities, and students talked about their roles in a national dialogue to begin in about a week. Today, they submitted their recommendations to the government. Rajab Muhandis, Executive Director of South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections, read a statement from the task force to reporters, which recommends the dialogue held without a patron, in the interest of consensus. Asked if that means President Kiir should step down as patron, Muhandis had this to say.
It sounds like the participants or the citizens generally who have been engaging in this consultative meeting are interested to see the process, the national dialogue proceed without the president being the patron.
Muhandis says, in order for the dialogue to be free and accessible to all South Sudanese, the government must first end all forms of insecurity in the country.
The transitional government of national unity stabilizes the situation in the country to create a conducive environment for citizens to meaningfully participate in the national dialogue. Recommend that the promise of the president to guarantee safety and freedom of the actors who are going to participate in the national dialogue, including those who are currently out of the country, some of whom are opposed to the government, be translated into action.
Muhandis says the recommendations put forward by the task force reflect the broad view of South Sudanese groups.
The degree to which they are considered determines the credibility of the national dialogue. It explains that the steering committee and those involved in heading this process are interested to execute this program in a manner that responds to the aspirations of the ordinary citizens.
Moses Monday John, Executive Director at Organization for Nonviolence and Development, says the task force will monitor the work of the National Dialogue Secretariat and the steering committee, which is supposed to be sworn in this week.
We will definitely be following it up with the Peace Commission and also with the National Secretariat. We expect also a constructive discussions in presence of the Peace Commission as well as with the National Secretariat.
Monday says the government should also give civil society organizations and the media unfettered access to reach communities across the country.
We are really calling that we wanted unhindered access to all parts of this country so that we can be able to listen to the people, captured their aspirations and their concerns, and fit in that concerns into this national dialogue process.
For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Today's Monday, March 6th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Last Friday's Supreme Court ruling in Liberia is likely to have wide-ranging implications for that country's 2017 presidential and parliamentary elections. The court ruled that a code of conduct for public officials was constitutional. The court requires certain officials of government seeking to run for elected offices to resign 2 years before election and others 3 years before. This means some presidential and parliamentary aspirants for this year's election are disqualified for running. Bong County Superintendent Selina Paulson Mappe had asked the court to declare the code of conduct unconstitutional. She said she's disappointed but not discouraged. She tells me her only concern is that the ruling may put a question mark on a peaceful election and transition.
I am disappointed, but I'm not discouraged because I know that I have a whole lot ahead of me. I'm a young person who has decided to venture into the political water. If I'm disappointed this kind of way, you know, it makes me feel very bad, but I'm not discouraged. The Constitution of the Republic of Liberia gives everyone the right to exercise their political rights. The law is coming into play that will stop other people from exercising their political rights. It just disappoints me, but at the same time, I think I'm encouraged because I have a whole lot ahead of me, like I said before.
Now, are you still superintendent?
I'm still the superintendent of Bong County, and someone had to challenge this law. Someone had to take it to the Supreme Court so that the Supreme Court could interpret it. And if the Supreme Court interpreted it this way, that we did not expect, albeit this is the highest law body of the country, what have we to say?
The way we understand, this ruling is going to impact the 2017 presidential election. Is that correct?
Exactly. It has impacted a lot of people negatively, and I'm just afraid, you know, for our country. I'm hoping that, you know, we can have a peaceful transition, we can have a peaceful election, but with this one coming into play, I mean, it poses a serious question.
Ms. Mappe, do you also understand perhaps the reason that this particular law was put in place is just because some people in government like yourself were taking advantage of the people, using your government position to continue to benefit to the disadvantage of other candidates?
Look, let me just say it to you. Even the very people that made the law, who are the lawmakers, they themselves are using the resources to continue to be in power. Because you have vehicles that these very people ride, and these vehicles are purchased from public funds. They have this huge salary. And where is the salary coming from? It's coming from taxpayers' money. Then you also have the better lawmakers. They've got people that are employed in their offices on government payroll. It is the state resources that they are using. I am a superintendent. How much money do I preside over? What government resources do I really have at my disposal to use and take advantage of other people? No. It is all wrong. The real people, they are the ones who preside over the national budget and make decisions on the national budget. They put money in there, what they call legislative earmark for projects that will be implemented by them. They have a greater say as per the implementation of those projects.
Do you believe that perhaps members of the legislature put this code of conduct in to protect themselves?
They want to perpetuate themselves. Some of them are hiding behind the code of conduct to perpetuate themselves.
Selina Paulson Mappe is superintendent of Liberia's Bong County. She was speaking with me from central Liberia. In Sierra Leone, the majority leader of the House of Representatives has announced he will seek the flag bearership for the ruling All People's Congress Party of President Ernest Bai Koroma. Two senior advisors to the president have already declared their candidacy. Majority Leader Ibrahim Bundu says his years of experience coupled with petitions from the citizens qualify him to carry on President Koroma's development agenda.
I've been a member of parliament for 15 years now. 2017 made me 15 years of being a member of parliament. I've been a founding member of the All People's Congress North American branch while I was there, and I was organizing secretary. Left in 2002, I came home and contested the first election. And up to today, my people have returned me to parliament 3 times. So with this in mind, coupled with the inspiration from my people, I believe that is a good base, a good recipe for me to go ahead. And I was particularly requested by my people loudly and clearly. They chanted, flag bearer, flag bearer, and they wanted me to go for flag bearer. That besides, I have the tremendous confidence in myself motivated me to run for the presidency, for the flag bearer of the APC, to continue the good work of His Excellency Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma, because I've worked with him during the opposition.
Sir, there are already two advisors to President Ernest Bai Koroma who have also announced they are running. In fact, one of them, Mr. Kanu, told me a week ago that, in fact, he was an apprentice to the president and that that really qualified him to succeed the president.
Well, I admire him for describing himself as an apprentice. I believe all of us, we are in the process of apprenticeship when we were in the opposition. And that apprenticeship graduated us to the position of a driving seat for the country. Yeah, and Ernest Koroma happens to be there at the helm. So all of us, we are given responsibilities. And my responsibility is to be in charge of the legislative arm of government where I am at the helm, being the majority leader and the leader of the House and leader of government business. So I cannot afford to call myself an apprentice again. This is time for the APC and ourselves to govern. We don't practice to govern. We have practiced during our days as in the opposition.
I spoke with a member of the main opposition, SLPP, and it seemed to suggest to me that I'm wondering now why you all are clamoring to succeed President Ernest Bai Koroma. The opposition SLPP is saying that, you know, under President Ernest Bai Koroma, the economy went bad. They talk about austerity measures that, you know, now are being introduced when the government should have dealt with all these things. What do you say to that criticism?
You don't expect the SLPP opposition member to say otherwise. We pay him to oppose us. So he's doing his job. I have a different view, and I know what he's saying, and I know what we are doing. It's for the people of this country to judge.
Ibrahim Bundu is Majority Leader of Sierra Leone's Parliament. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Facebook's head of products, Chris Cox, wrapped up a tour of West Africa in Dakar over the weekend. He told Ricky Strike that representatives from Facebook and Instagram visited Nigeria, Ghana, and Senegal over the past week because West Africa is of growing importance to the online platforms, especially when it comes to promoting creative communities.
So to begin 2017, we've chosen West Africa as a place to come and learn, in many ways because it's at the forefront of using mobile technology to tell stories, to spread culture, to celebrate national identity across many different forms, in fashion, in cooking, in music, in film, as well as to grow businesses and to be a place that developers can build on top of. What we observed was so interesting about Senegal specifically was the use of Instagram and our tools to celebrate national culture. Whether it was food, like rice, like celebrating the quality of the local rice versus imported rice, the fashion. Facebook and Instagram's focus in 2017 is a lot on building community, building local community. And the way that creators bring together communities of people around them who celebrate whatever it is that they're trying to celebrate.
Talking about creatives who kind of sell their things on the platform, and within West Africa especially, sometimes people don't have credit cards because people use Orange money, they use SMS to pay their money. Like, has there been talk of creating a way using the platform to pay?
So we're constantly trying to add new ways to pay. We're going in order of essentially how much demand there is. It's a combination of how much demand is there to pay in a certain way and then the technical difficulty. We just announced support for Naira, as a currency that you can now pay to buy marketing on Facebook. And we're going to continue to add payment options as quickly as we can.
There are still some areas where internet access is very hard. Does Facebook and Instagram work with local bodies to help make the 3G and the 4G work a little bit better?
So internet.org is a broad program that's addressing connectivity. In the short run, we have free basics, which is a program where we work with telcos, local telcos, to deliver a free set of internet services around health, around education, around news, weather, sports, entertainment, to people who are coming onto the internet for the first time and or for whom affordability is an issue. We also have a program called Express Wi-Fi, which works with local ISPs to let an internet cafe or like an electronics shop provide fast internet. And then in the long term, we're working on a project to fly planes, which are, it's called Aquila. And it's this wingspan of a 777, but it's as light as a small truck. And it's made of carbon fiber, it has solar panels on the top, it flies around at 70,000 feet, and it tries to beam down internet with lasers.
That was Chris Cox, head of products at Facebook, speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with the semi-final pairings in the CAF Under 20 African Cup of Nations currently taking place in Zambia. 2 second-half goals in the space of 6 minutes handed South Africa an impressive 3-1 win over Sudan in their final Under 20 CAF African Cup of Nations Group B game on Sunday at the National Heroes Stadium. The result, combined with Senegal's 2-0 win over Cameroon in the other Group B game at the same time on Sunday, means South Africa finished second in the standings and thus qualified for the semi-finals of the competition. South Africa finished second in Group B with 6 points following 2 wins and a loss. Senegal ended the group stages unbeaten after 2 wins and a draw, which leaves them on 7 points. Cameroon and Sudan both exit the tournament after finishing third with 3 points and fourth with 1 point, respectively. Senegal will now take on Guinea in the semi-final of the Under-20 AFCON on Thursday, March the 9th, while South Africa will face host Zambia on Wednesday, March the 8th. With Senegal and South Africa both qualifying from the group stages means they have also qualified for the Under-20 FIFA World Cup, which will get on the way in May later this year. Elsewhere, Malawi's Minister for Labour, Youth and Sport and Manpower Development, Henry Musa, has described the Kamuzu Stadium in Malawi as a death trap and has indicated that the stadium will be demolished. He said government has already set aside mechanisms on how the processes of demolishing the facility will be done. The sport minister said the plan is to construct a new stadium at the site once the current structure has been demolished. In cricket news, Kagiso Rabada and Imran Tahir led a lethal bowling display by the Proteas of South Africa that laid the foundation for a fine 3-2 series win over New Zealand with a 6-wicket triumph in the 5th one-day international ODI Auckland on Saturday. In what has been a seesaw sequence of matches, South Africa gave the host little chance at halfway of the decisive encounter by bundling them out of the paltry 149 after winning the toss and electing the bow first at Eden Park. Elsewhere, Kenya Sevens on Sunday secured a place in the final Las Vegas Sevens at the Sam Bayard Stadium. All-time series try-scorer Collins Injera touched down Kenya's decisive try to send Shujia into the final, where the East Africans will either meet Scotland or Samoa. The Challenge Trophy final will be played on Monday on the third of the action in the 5th leg of the World Rugby Series. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, March 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte saying have a lovely day.
Next on Let's Talk, domestic violence. Problem that faces societies worldwide. Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing domestic violence. Let's Talk comes to you Monday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I am Shaka Thali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss International Women's Day. It's also known as the United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace, celebrating women's achievements throughout history. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.